From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that's interesting, fun, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
Our first guest this morning, Dr. Mike Cossely. He's the Vice President of Analytics and Behavioral Science at Penumbra. Now, Penumbra is a company that provides immersive virtual reality experience for patients of healthcare professionals that are involved in physical therapy, mental therapy, and mental health therapy, and other age-related therapies. We look forward to our conversation with Mike.
And then we speak with Anna Lemke. She's the medical director of addiction medicine at Stanford University. She's written a new book called Dopamine Nation. Dr. Lemke explores exciting new scientific discoveries that explain why the relentless pursuit of pleasure leads to pain, while also offering a practical solutions for how to manage compulsive overconsumption, providing a path back to a balanced life.
Our guest is Dr. Mike Cossely. He's the Vice President of Analytics and Behavioral Science at Penumbra. Now, this company provides virtual reality, VR, immersive experiences for people that suffer from depression, anxiety, physical pain, loneliness, and age-related challenges. Mike Cossely, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, great to have you. And I remember my first experience with VR maybe 15 or 20 years ago, and it was obvious that it was extremely powerful, but it was lacking in applications. The promise for future applications was exciting, though. Education, healthcare, training, you know, outside of the gaming part that it was in at the time. That promise seems to be unfolding in front of us, doesn't it?
That's right. So I've been fortunate enough to work now in a couple different capacities in the VR space. You mentioned training, learning, education, and now most currently working in the healthcare space, which I guess says a lot about how far the field has come that I've been able to kind of work quite a bit on both those applications, which is kind of goes well beyond gaming, as you mentioned.
Yeah, and there are a number of products with your company, the Real Immersive System for people that are going through PT. You also have things for people that are experiencing cognitive decline or mental health issues. Can you maybe pick one of those and tell us about it?
Sure. So this is a relatively new space for us, so I can I'll only go into a little bit of detail here, but the it's pretty fascinating when you think about the medium of VR. And you mentioned, you know, it now realizing different applications outside the space of gaming. And from my perspective, that's really all about the ability for this medium to change behavior in meaningful ways, in predictable ways, right? So if you think about a lot of what happens in kind of neurocognitive therapy, you know, if we want to kind of take an example of someone with Parkinson's disease impairment, for example, a lot of the neurocognitive along with those kind of other physical impairments really focus around, you know, kind of memory. Perseveration is a big cognitive as well as physical impairment. And this is the idea that these particular patient types have trouble switching away cognitively, right, from particular whatever it is, thoughts are typical, or, you know, even kind of focusing their attention and not being able to switch away in any kind of visual setting. And so the inability to kind of switch attention is a big problem. Of course, if you think about just what we do in our daily lives, it's constantly what we're doing, probably too much now with things like social media, but this is a real thing. And so kind of along with other memory impairments, this becomes a real problem for folks with Parkinson's disease. And so by engaging in these therapies, they're able to, you know, kind of basically improve those cognitive impairments. And that, and just to kind of talk about VR for a second, I mean, therapy happens now, and for a lot of folks it's successful, for a lot of folks it's not successful. When you start to incorporate things like virtual reality environments, what happens is there's a sense of engagement. It's probably better well defined in the neuroscience than just the term engagement, but we all as kind of lay people can understand that when you're in kind of an experience or you're doing anything in life, really, that captures your attention and you're really focused in making things effortful and goal-directed, the outcomes, right, the behavior change really is what we're after, those are going to be improved. If you're going through therapy, or doesn't even need to be therapy, could be, again, doing anything kind of in life, and you're not fully engaged and fully captured with your attention, you're not going to be as effective in terms of improving the behavior change. And we all know that just from kind of different things we've done in life, whether that's in sports or in education, et cetera, at work. And so that's what VR really provides minimally, is a better medium to be able to facilitate those types of engagement, motivation, behaviors, which are going to lead to better outcomes. So in the case of, you know, going back to the Parkinson's patients, we can provide a better way for those folks to get their therapy so that they are more engaged, they're more motivated, so that those cognitive impairments, those visual attention, memory impairments are then improved. There's a greater chance that they're going to improve, and they're going to improve potentially more quickly even in therapy using those virtual reality simulations. And this has been studied now a little bit. The academic community has done kind of a lot of groundwork in different areas. Parkinson's disease is probably a little bit understudied, but I think it's an incredibly fruitful area for us to be able to improve the lives of these folks.
It's a fascinating area, Mike. And, I remember, I think it was probably 3 or 4 years ago, John and I spoke with an instructor at the University of Utah Dental School, and they were using VR to train their students on, for example, how to perform a root canal, and they would, or whatever procedure it was, you know, fill a cavity, and they would do it over and over and over so that the student can really grasp almost like a muscle memory, or, you know, bring it into a cognitive experience where they could grasp the knowledge in a way that they never could have done, you know, practicing a procedure here and there. And I think that was the first time that I thought, wow, this world of VR is unbelievably vast, and we're not even scratching the surface of it. But, you know, someone like you working at Penumbra, this is what you're doing on a daily basis. How do you see it operating now in the marketplace, or with the, you know, willingness of patients and consumers, getting on board?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think it's something that everyone who's in this space is asking themselves every day, and the question is really focused around adoption. And I think just to take a step back, when we talk about virtual reality, one of the issues, I don't know, it's a real problem that kind of prohibits the adoption of technology, but I do think it's something that needs to be addressed, which is, how do we define virtual reality, right? Because in virtual reality technology, because there's a gamut of technologies that are out there that all fall under the label virtual reality. And I think we're starting to actually even see the labeling, right, of these technologies. You think about things like XR. Facebook recently came out with their declaration of kind of going after, the kind of metaverse space. And so these words aren't really kind of super well defined at this point. So when we say virtual reality, I think it's important to know kind of what technology we're dealing with. And because that has big implications on things like adoption and acceptance. When the Oculus device came out about 10 years ago, a little bit more than 10 years ago, that was a big shift, because that took things out of the laboratory, right? So these were big clunky devices that were tethered, and eventually, you know, they became untethered so that they're standalone, a little bit more like a mobile device. So that has helped the acceptance a lot more than what was done kind of previously with these technologies, or what had happened previously with these technologies. I think what we're going to see too is a continuing focus on making this a more and more friendly entry into kind of the virtual reality space, in the sense that the form factor, the experiences, the content, the seamlessness of it will be a lot more apparent. I also think, and it's worth noting here, that there's a lot of technologies that are coming to bear that will kind of integrate with the real environment. So we call these devices augmented reality, right? So this is the idea that you can take, you know, someone and not have to put a headset on them and totally immerse them, but you can actually work with the current environment and augment that environment by inserting kind of, you know, things that are that are not part of the current reality, but you can kind of integrate them so that you're having this augmented reality environment. So that's been huge, right, in terms of individuals being able to understand and accept these devices. So the technology, the form factor. I think what we're also seeing are leaders in this space. So I worked with a company called Striver, and you mentioned kind of a training application for dentists. Mm-hmm. The fact that we had kind of the biggest companies in the world, the Walmart, et cetera, willing to adopt these technologies and show value for them has been a huge kind of boon for the acceptance of, for other companies, right, to start to look at this technology a little bit more seriously. And then there's a lot of work that's been done to kind of make, again, to kind of ease the friction points. It's not just having the headset and the content. You need to figure out how this is going to live in a company, right? Where does it actually sit, you know, in an organization? Is it in the warehouse? Is it in the corporate offices, et cetera? And is there a plan for kind of using these technologies consistently in those spaces? And so that was all stuff that these companies are starting to figure out, that we had to figure out at Striver, certainly, and we're figuring out Penumbra as well. So that's been an interesting ride, and I think a lot of work has been done over the last 5 or 6 years to really focus on that. And that's made the adoption, like I said, a lot easier and a lot more accepted.
Let's talk a little bit about mental health therapy. And, you know, I'm wondering how many therapists in their office, when they, you know, someone comes in to address their issues with depression or anxiety, you know, again, this is back to the adoption, but, you know, using these kinds of, whether it's virtual reality or augmented reality, you know, what's being used in a, you know, one individual's office right now?
It really varies. And, you know, again, these are early days for the adoption of these technologies, but typically what we'll see in what's been done with other organizations as well that have, you know, kind of tried to provide, you know, therapy in this space toward those kind of mental health ends that you mentioned, is that they'll have headsets loaded with, you know, a lot of content so that patients can kind of go in and give them an opportunity to kind of also select. And ideally, this is done in a self-guided way. Mm-hmm. And so there's not a lot of need for the therapist or other kind of clinicians or anybody to administrate the experiences. That's a huge part of this, right, is the patient, when they need it, can actually access it. I think that's a big problem with therapy in general, is the access issue, right? We don't have the ability to always see someone. We don't always have the ability to go into a clinic, especially for those folks in very remote environments. This technology provides the ability for someone to be able to kind of get in and get out whenever they need to. And I think that kind of on-demand ability to provide therapy has been huge. And so in the office setting or in the clinic setting, we do provide, you know, those headsets, the hardware, along with the content. But really, we've been working with those kind of central locations to be able to figure out what's the best way for patients then to access. And that's looked like a lot of different things at this point. Sometimes it gets incorporated, right, with their therapy. And so they come into an office like they would for a regular therapy session, and it's there. In hospital settings, so thinking about things like pain management, another big kind of application is also pre-operative, pre-surgical kind of, you know, anxiety. Is a big kind of thing to address as well. So being able to provide those systems so that, you know, hospitals could administer them as they see fit to their patients as well is important. But again, all this is made really kind of not simple, but certainly easier by the fact that the technology has advanced so much that we can have these standalone devices. And so you can just basically pick one up, like you would pick up a mobile phone, and just give it to a patient, and it's pretty easy for them to just use on their own. That's been the use case so far. Certainly thinking about what would this look like when it goes direct to consumer. I think we're pretty far from that at this point, but there's certainly a future state when we see kind of, again, even greater kind of uptick in adoption of this technology where folks can just have this at home, right? And so now the therapy can be really kind of guided, self-guided, direct in your home instead of having to go to a clinic. You could even think about connecting patient and clinician remotely so that if you do want to jump in a headset, you have the clinician available, even though they're in a different geographical location. So that's really exciting to think about for us as well. And that's going to really provide better outcomes, right? Access and not doing the therapy are really kind of the biggest factors for why folks don't get better.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are talking with Dr. Mike Casale. He's the Vice President of Analytics and Behavioral Science at Penumbra. Penumbra provides immersive virtual reality experiences for healthcare professionals that have customers have patients in physical therapy, mental health therapy, and other age-related therapies. Mike, on your website, you have a number of case studies, and I just really get it. Reading these case studies. So, for an example, Brandon is involved in a functional movement rehabilitation. A couple years ago, he had a stroke that left him with a number of impairments, including a right-sided weakness and paralysis and difficulty speaking. And you all set him up with this bird forest activities where he had the goggles on. He's totally in this immersive experience. And with his right hand, which is the hand that they're trying to get more movement on, he has sensors, and he's moving, he's picking up a bird and moving it to another location, and he's totally in this experience. He says after 25 minutes, he admitted to feeling physically tired, but he said his favorite aspect of Real System is it doesn't feel like an exercise because he's so focused on the birds and not really just going through the motions. I think the utility is that he's getting better, but at the same time, you also, through virtual reality, are able to capture metrics so that you can measure specifically how he's doing this session versus the last session. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, and it's a great use case, and it's something that, you know, at Summer we've been focused on a lot, which is that that stroke rehabilitation, getting folks back to their to some sort of, you know, improvement with their motor functioning post-stroke, right? And that's something that obviously happens now with therapy. We think, you know, with the, you know, introduction of VR, we're able to improve that, and I can talk a little bit about some of those elements. But as far as the kind of data and analytics that we track, I think that's something that, you know, I didn't even mention kind of as part of the value in general. And I think this is true across different applications of VR, but certainly in the clinical space, the ability for us to better understand how a patient is progressing through therapy, I think is a huge value add. So currently, you know, when a patient is a therapist in the clinic, they're often assessed, and then therapy is conducted over, you know, the course of weeks. And a lot of the progress that's tracked is, you know, something that happens, you know, visually, somewhat qualitatively, and somewhat informally. And not to say that, you know, the patient is improving or that that leads to kind of not the best outcomes. But I think what it does imply is that we don't always know how patients are improving from the kind of session-to-session therapies. And so it's not always clear for therapists and for others, frankly, that are involved in the patients, like the patient themselves, how they're getting better. And if I think about kind of what this system can do, we can better track movement, right? So if you think about the eyeballs of the therapist and even some of their other kind of ways that they're measuring improvement, it's not necessarily bad, but it can be improved upon, right? So we can start to think about the measures that we capture as they're going through VR. We're looking at how their arm's moving, the quality of movement. So things like how fast is it moving? Is it moving in the right direction? Are folks compensating in a way that's going to lead to kind of work, like not the optimal outcomes that we're looking for? And how do we kind of correct that? Can we even do that in real time in the game? And so these start to kind of like introduce a whole new set of insights, right, for not only the therapist and the patient, but for ways in which we can start to redirect or adjust or adapt the therapy. So now we think about things like, you know, the personalized medicine approach, where we now understand that particular patient, how they're progressing through therapy in a way that's unique for that patient, in a way that allows us to say, okay, if they're kind of continuing to compensate in such a kind of fine way that's not able to be really distinguished by the therapist themselves, we can then say, okay, here's what we recommend to do next therapy. So that gives therapists a lot more power, right, to better understand if my patient's not progressing in the way that I want, or if they're progressing, you know, better than I thought, I can start to adjust and adapt the therapy. That often doesn't happen now because of the lack of nuance, and it's difficult, right? Therapists have a very difficult life in the sense that They're having to see a lot of patients. They don't have a lot of time. They certainly don't have a lot of access, right, in the way that they would want to their patients. The patients sometimes don't even come in. Now imagine doing this even in a remote setting. And now you get to see all kinds of things kind of unfold right when they're in the home. You get insights, you get more data, basically, to be able to make those better assessments about the patient. And again, provide them with a more effective and adaptive kind of line of therapy that will, we think, will improve outcomes ultimately at the end of the day. And so that's, to me, that's where I really see the power of the data for virtual reality in these settings. Of course, you can extend that out to even training and education, right? So that you can better understand how someone's learning and progressing in the same way that someone's going through therapy. Those unique insights can help an instructor, for example, be able to tailor material accordingly. And that's kind of the cool vision and the cool future that I've imagined for VR now for a few years.
Sure. Well, all of these applications are important. If it's PT, stroke victims, people with physical pain, the thing that really grabs my attention are the people that are suffering with emotional pain. And certainly, before COVID, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, 11% of adults reported symptoms of anxiety disorder and or depressive disorder. 2 years later, in January 2021, the numbers had increased from 11% to 41% of adults reporting those same symptoms. Also, kids that have thoughts of suicide rose from 10.7% in 2018 to 26% in 2020 during the pandemic. So this is something that's really caught my attention, because therapists are difficult to find, and we need other strategies to help some of these people. Before we let you go, what are your thoughts on what you can do to help people that are suffering with emotional pain?
Yeah, it's another great question, and I think we're seeing a couple things generally happening in this space that are really encouraging. One is more attention to things like kind of mindfulness practices, right? So thinking about the reduction of anxiety and a lot of the good that that can do. A lot of, kind of the thoughts, right, that kind of dwell and plague a lot of folks, especially, in these days where things are a lot more uncertain. The pandemic has certainly introduced a lot of kind of mental anguish for a lot of people. Kind of refocusing on things that we can do. And again, there's a lot of things that are going to be beyond our control that will, kind of continue to unfortunately breed, kind of these mental health issues. But I think there's a lot we can do to try to combat that. Again, things like, mindfulness practices, that are becoming a lot more popular is one way to do that. And we're seeing that, and kind of coincidentally, kind of technology being able to facilitate that. So a lot of folks have kind of used their mobile phones now, right, to have guided meditation and mindfulness sessions. We think virtual reality actually can be even a better environment for that, in not just being able to provide a better environment, but now you're, again, thinking about analytics and metrics. We can provide that biofeedback to the patient so they can know, how is that mindfulness practice going, and am I actually able to control some of those kind of emotions and those thoughts that, like I mentioned, that kind of plague us. And so that's really encouraging to me, is that we're seeing a lot of folks kind of not just buy into this idea of wellness and mental health wellness, but that we're providing the technology. And again, I think because of the ability for VR to get you in different spaces and different environments, plus the ability to kind of track some of that really important information and feed that back to the patient, I think that's going to be a huge win for everyone, and certainly something that we're interested in and excited in at Penumbra.
Well, Mike, we're going to keep track of what you all are doing at Penumbra, so let's stay in touch. Loved having you on the show this morning, and we look forward to the next conversation with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Absolutely. Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Our next guest is Anna Limke. She's the medical director of addiction medicine at Stanford University. She's just written a new book, Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. Now, I'll bet sometime in your life, someone told you that everything was okay in moderation. Well, easier said than done. With today's overwhelming abundance of food, drugs, alcohol, shopping, gambling, social media, you name it. And it all can be compulsively overconsumed. And it's all waiting for you right there on your smartphone. Well, here to help us understand the latest in the science of addiction is Dr. Anna Limke. Anna, welcome to Cool Science Radio. Great to have you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Your book is so exciting, and I know that because you work in dopamine on a daily basis, maybe we need to go back to those of us as lay people. You know, we know a little bit about dopamine and a little bit about serotonin and maybe the relationship between them, but can you take us back to what those two brain chemicals do?
Sure. So dopamine is a neurotransmitter, which means that it's a chemical in the brain that helps one neuron communicate with the next neuron. So neurons are the cells in our brain that send electrical impulses to create circuits which make emotions and thoughts. But neurons don't touch end to end. There's a little space between them called the synapse. And bridging the gap in that synapse is neurotransmitters like serotonin, like norepinephrine, like dopamine. And they are integral to a lot of our emotions and thoughts and feelings. And dopamine is especially important to motivation, reward, and pleasure. It's also the molecule that is involved in the process of becoming addicted.
Yeah. So dopamine is something that we all seek out. It's the feeling I get when my husband brings me a cup of coffee at 6 a.m. when I'm in bed, and I get that little feeling of pleasure. But we seek this, and we have begun to seek it in a way that has created an addiction. And in the book, you talk about this point. It's sort of the breaking point where pleasure becomes pain. Can you go into that a little bit?
Sure. So, our brains have evolved over millions of years to approach pleasure and avoid pain, and it's what's kept us alive in a world of scarcity and ever-present danger. The problem is that we no longer live in that world. As you said in your intro, we live in this world of overwhelming abundance where all of our survival needs are met, and we're surrounded by these highly drugified substances and behaviors, and even behaviors that seem sort of innocent on the face of it, like novels. Reading novels have, in a sense, become drugified. We've sort of figured out exactly how to produce a novel so that it's highly reinforcing. And I talk in the book about my romance novel addiction, just as an illustration of how at this point it's possible to get addicted to anything. So in order to understand what's happening in the brain, it's what I tell my medical students and my patients is that imagine in your brain there's a balance, kind of like a teeter-totter in a kid's playground. And when we experience something pleasurable, it tips to the side of pleasure. And when we experience pain, it tips to the side of pain. But one of the overriding rules governing this balance, this seesaw, is that it wants to remain level. It does not want to be tipped for very long to the side of pleasure or of pain. And when you think about that from an evolutionary perspective, it makes sense, right? If you're in a world of scarcity and ever-present danger, your pleasure-pain balance wants to quickly restore a level balance so that you keep seeking out the next source of food, clothing, a shelter, a mate, and you want to remain vigilant because there are predators all around. And the way that the balance restores homeostasis or gets back to the level position is that once we've tipped it to one side, it tips an equal and opposite amount to the other side. So, for example, if I have a piece of chocolate, I release a little dopamine in my brain's reward pathway. It's a special area in the brain. And my balance tips to the side of pleasure. But no sooner has that happened than my brain adapts by down-regulating my own production of dopamine and my own dopamine transmission. And I like to imagine that as these little gremlins, these neuroadaptation gremlins, hopping on the pain side of the balance to bring it level again. But the gremlins like it on the balance, so they don't get off right when it's level. They wait until my balance is tipped an equal and opposite amount to the side of pain. And that's the come down, the hangover, the after effect, or in my case, wanting a second piece of chocolate. Mm-hmm. Now, if we wait long enough, that feeling passes, the gremlins hop off, and balance is restored. But if we continue to inundate our dopamine reward pathways with highly reinforcing substances and behaviors, we end up with so many gremlins on the pain side of the balance that they could fill a whole room. In other words, we end up in a kind of chronic dopamine deficit state where we are then seeking out our drug of choice not to feel good, but just to level the balance and feel normal. And when we're not using our drug of choice, we experience the universal symptoms of withdrawal from any addictive substance: anxiety, irritability, insomnia, dysphoria, and intrusive thoughts of wanting to get our drug. And for your listeners out there who have no personal or family experience with what we typically think of as addiction, just think for a moment about your relationship with your smartphone and how hard it is to pull away and stop tapping and swiping. That's because your balance has tipped to the side of pain and you're essentially in withdrawal. It's also why once you put it away, you almost can't stop thinking about it.
Boy, it's fascinating. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Dr. Anna Lemke. She's the medical director of addiction medicine at Stanford University. She's just written an incredible book, Dopamine Nation: Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. Anna, let's go back to chocolate. I'm curious about multiple pleasure pain tipping at the same time. So let's say you're cooking dinner and you pour yourself a glass of red wine while you're cooking, and you say to yourself, you know, I'm only going to have one glass. So you kind of set the stage for disappointment coming. And you take a piece of chocolate because someone told you, you know, chocolate and red wine goes really well together. And you're making dinner. You have a friend that comes over and brings cheese and crackers, and maybe someone else shows up with a pretty cool-looking dessert. multiple tipping points going on at the same time. What happens when that happens? And I'm curious. I hear that willpower is like a muscle and that it gets tired. Does that play into this somehow?
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So what you're getting at is sort of different types of drugs, and it's, your implied question is, do they all sort of work the same way on the same reward pathway? And the answer is yes, they do. All of these drugs, whether it's video games or cocaine or alcohol or what have you, in my case, romance novels, they all work, you know, on the same reward pathway. And the same common molecule that gets released is dopamine. So dopamine is not the only neurotransmitter involved in pleasure, reward, and addiction, but it's probably the most important one. And there's something called cross-addiction, whereby if you become addicted to one substance, you are more likely to get addicted to another substance. So there's some sort of latent echo that goes on. Also, one of the ways to overcome tolerance, and tolerance is one of the signs of becoming addicted, it's where the gremlins accumulate on the pain side of the balance. You need more and more of your drug to get the same effect, or you need more potent forms. And one of the classic ways to overcome tolerance and to increase potency of any drug is to combine it with another drug. So, for example, people who misuse opioids often combine it with things like Xanax, because when you put those two together, you get a more potent drug. So somebody who enjoys red wine with dinner might find after a while that red wine is sort of deflating or not quite as reinforcing, and then might combine red wine with chocolate cake to sort of augment the feeling or maintain the feeling. But basically, all of those substances are working on the same common reward pathway, which is why the sort of generic advice of, well, if you're trying to give up one substance that you're consuming compulsively in a way that concerns you, just replace it with another reinforcing reward, doesn't really work in the long run, because at the end of the day, either that second reward won't be potent enough to overcome the gremlins you've accumulated on the pain side of your balance, or you'll just get addicted to that second substance. Now, as far as your question regarding willpower, one of the points that I make in the book is indeed that willpower is usually not sufficient, precisely because when we wake up in the morning, we have more willpower than we're going to have at the end of the day. And so it's hard to exercise that when we're tired and we come home from work and we say to ourselves, well, I wasn't going to drink, but now I'm going to. And the point that I make in the book is that just relying on willpower probably isn't going to work for most of us. What we need to do is actually change our environment by creating self-binding strategies. Self-binding strategies are physical and metacognitive barriers between ourselves and our drug of choice so that we can press the pause button between desire and consumption. Because the truth is, once we have the opportunity to use our drug of choice and we're in the throes of desire, there's really no deciding. So it's things like not keeping alcohol in your home, or deleting certain apps from your smartphone, or restricting your use to certain times of the day, or only with friends, or only on special occasions. These are the types of things that we have to do in advance. We have to change our environment, especially when we're living in a world of overwhelming amounts of dopamine.
How long has this discovery been out there that the same part of our brain that processes pleasure processes pain? I mean, that's got to be a major shift. And follow-up to that is, if it happened in the last 10 or 15 years and you've been practicing for 20 years helping patients with addiction, how has your practice changed towards helping those people?
Yeah, great question. So I also agree this is really one of the most exciting scientific discoveries in the last 75 years, that the same parts of the brain that process pleasure also process pain. I find that absolutely fascinating. But here's what's even more interesting, that philosophers from ancient Greece, people like Plato and Socrates, actually presaged this, which I love, when thousands of years ago, for example, the atomic theory, it's the same thing. Philosophers anticipated what science would later discover. And so people like Plato and Socrates very early on said, you know, it's fascinating. It seems that whenever we experience pleasure, quickly on the heels of that, we experience pain, and vice versa. So one of the main points I make in the book, too, is that a better way to get your dopamine is actually to do things that are hard and challenging and painful, and then kick into action our brain's own homeostatic healing, upregulation of dopamine as a more enduring way to get that pleasure. So as far as my practice, you know, I've really... my practice has really been transformed by this information. When I first started out 25 years ago, I was very quick to prescribe all kinds of feel-good medications and encourage my patients to not do anything that was harmful or challenging. I was taught that, you know, if people are in pain, then something's wrong and I need to do everything in my power as a healthcare provider to alleviate that pain. And what I've come to discover is that in some cases where I'm really doing a patient's disservice, and instead what I need to do is encourage them to lean into their suffering and use it as a way to build resilience.
Mm. We're speaking with Dr. Anna Limke. Her book is Dopamine Nation. And I wanted to ask you, you're the medical director of the Stanford Addiction Medicine Program, rather, and I find that every so often we talk to someone from Stanford and they have, and you all have these areas of study that I don't often hear about in any other universities. I mean, there's the the Center for, you know, Gender Identity at Stanford and the, you know, Center for Addiction Medicine at Stanford.
Human Interaction.
Yes. I mean, what is going on there at Stanford? And you know, you must have tremendous support for the work that you do there.
You know, Stanford is a really great place in that it fosters creativity. But one of my favorite things that Mark Testy-Levine, our president, said when he first came here, he said, you know, Stanford is great at organic, but not very good at organized, which I think is a really fair critique. We have a lot of very creative people who think and work cross-discipline, but sometimes they don't necessarily talk to each other. The other thing that I would say is that, you know, Silicon Valley is a very interesting place at this moment in history. And one of the things that I was really trying to convey in my book, Dopamine Nation, where I talk about, you know, with the gracious and generous support of the patients who are discussed in the book, how, you know, even a Stanford scientist can develop a sex addiction. And the patient I talk about, you know, used his scientific smarts to invent a masturbation machine. So it's this really, which I think is a very compelling metaphor for the intersection between technology, culture, and our emotional and psychological well-being. You know, Silicon Valley is just this very interesting place full of you know, characters at a pivotal moment in history that I, you know, I think it contributes to being an incubator for, you know, not always good ideas, but certainly lots of ideas.
Exactly. About 10 years ago, I was, I'll never forget this. It was this aha moment about social media, but my son and a couple of his friends are in the back of the car. They're in about middle school at this point, and it's just about when, I suppose at that point, they were using Facebook. Or maybe Instagram, I don't know, but one of the kids
probably
was saying,
Instagram or Snapchat. Or
I think you're right. I think it was Snapchat at that point for that age, you know, 13-year-olds. And this one kid was saying, oh, my post has gotten, you know, 53 likes. And then five minutes later, he was looking again. He said, now it's at 75 likes. And he just kept going.
Right.
And I thought, wow, this is dangerous. And I'm wondering, you know, we have gotten to a tipping point with our smartphones and with our social media and with very provocative films like The Social Dilemma. You know, so many people I know got rid of all their social media after seeing how much it controls us. Are we experiencing a positive shift in which we are armed now with the knowledge about what's happening to us by, in part, Silicon Valley, right? And are we going to say, I don't want it anymore? It's, you know, we're experiencing too much pain and we don't have that balance.
Yeah, I mean, I do think, so first of all, let me just say, I am, even though I talk about the ills of social media and how addictive it is and how drugified it is, I am actually very optimistic that the younger generations are going to figure this out. They're the ones who have been literally weaned on, metaphorically weaned on social media, and I think they're going to piece it together and discover, you know, that there are good things about it, and there's, and that we've got to figure out a way to orient on this new technology so that we're getting the good stuff and not amplifying the bad stuff. So I am actually, you know, things are not good now, but I do see us just by the mere fact that, for example, we're having this conversation now and people are having these conversations in their homes and with their friends and colleagues, like, oh, geez, you know, maybe spending this much time on social media or engaging, you know, this compulsively with how many likes I got or how many tweets, you know, is not a good thing.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, Anna Lemke is our guest. She's the medical director of addiction medicine at Stanford University. Anna, looking at strategies to get your teen to want to curb usage, maybe in gaming or social media, you've spoken in the past about using a strategy that was effective in getting teens to stop smoking a bunch of years ago. Can you tell us about that? Because I think our listeners at home are looking for strategies.
Yeah, so my book is really all about strategies. It's not just about the problem. And what I do is I hold up people in recovery from addiction as modern-day prophets for the rest of us who are struggling with these minor addictions, and also for parents who are trying to figure out how to educate their kids in this new dopamine-overloaded world. And one of the first strategies I recommend is a dopamine fast. I suggest that whatever your drug of choice is, whether it's video games or wine or social media, that you give it up for a month. And the reason that that's so important is because it gives time for our dopamine reward pathways to reset themselves. Another way of saying that is that it gives time for those gremlins that are hanging out on the pain side of the balance to hop off and for homeostasis to be restored. And that's essential because it allows us to enjoy other things again. One of the things that happens as we become addicted is that we become compulsively, narrowly focused on our drug of choice, and other things lose their color. They lose their salience. They lose their positivity. So it's by taking a break from our drug of choice for that 4 weeks that allows us to enjoy other things and to not be constantly compulsively thinking about using. It also allows us to look back and see true cause and effect, because when we're chasing dopamine, we don't really see it, be aware of it in the moment. The other thing, you know, that I always tell people, though, is that when they first stop using their drug of choice, they will go into withdrawal. And so they have to be prepared in those first couple of weeks to, you know, experience the universal symptoms of withdrawal from any addictive substance, including smartphones, which is anxiety, irritability, insomnia, depression, and intrusive thoughts of using. So it's important for people to be forewarned that they're going to feel worse before they feel better. And then once that dopamine fast is over, then it's a matter of thinking about, okay, am I going to go back to using? And most people want to go back to using their drug of choice. They don't want to continue to abstain, but then they want to use differently. They want to use less. So then I recommend these self-binding strategies to help people limit and moderate their use.
Well, we hope our parents use strategies that are effective. We hope that our kids will make some good decisions and maybe on their own. And as you mentioned in your book about trying to get kids to stop smoking, one of the effective strategies was to take them through all the executives that were misrepresenting data and were not telling the truth and those sorts of things that sort of duped everybody into smoking or thinking that it was safe. The same sort of thing when you look at, and I know you worked on Social Dilemma, you were in that movie, the same sort of thing, the facts that come from that, maybe kids will make their own decisions. Is that what you're saying? Is that one of the effective strategies?
Well, I mean, I think for families, what I recommend first is just opening the conversation to talk openly about how hard it is for all of us to put down our phones and to stop engaging with, you know, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, whatever, you know, whatever it is, and just sort of acknowledge that. But then secondly, to think about the neuroscience, you know, and to be aware of the ways in which these kinds of activities feel good in the moment, but make us feel worse afterwards. I find that for teenagers, that's really an aha moment because they can identify with that. That resonates for them. Like, oh yeah, you know, when I'm playing the video game, it feels great. Right after I turn it off, it's like falling off a cliff. And so to describe to them that, yes, that's your dopamine plummeting, not just to baseline levels, but below baseline levels, that's you essentially experiencing that dopamine deficit or withdrawal. That in itself can be very motivating because nobody wants to feel bad. And then, yeah, also recognizing that, you know, these social media apps have been engineered by the corporations making money on them to be addictive. For example, you know, they remember what we did last time and then they suggest to us another alternative, which engages our search and explore function, searching for novelty, which is a huge source of dopamine. So, and you know, teenagers especially resonate with not wanting to be controlled by adults. So, you know, if you look at smoking cessation campaigns for cigarettes, educating kids about how dangerous cigarettes are never really worked. But once kids were told, well, you know what, those CEOs in the corner office are making a lot of money off of you, then all of a sudden teenagers got interested in stopping because they didn't want to be, you know, anybody's pawn. So I think that that can be a useful angle as well.
I like that. That's really great. So you spend quite a bit of time in your book talking about this student that you met at Stanford named Chris, who came from Arkansas, and his struggle with addiction. And I just found it interesting because some of the words that he used, and finally when he got to a place of balance, which wasn't actually balance, it was a bit of an aha moment for you too. Can you tell his story?
Sure. So this was a young man who developed a very severe opioid addiction and tried abstinence repeatedly and just kept failing. And finally, he got on opioid agonist treatment, which is buprenorphine. It's an opioid used to treat opioid addiction. And it really saved his life and allowed him to return to Stanford and be a very successful student and graduate and go on to get a PhD. And, you know, the way to think about this from a biochemical perspective is that essentially through his drug use, he had tipped his balance sort of irreparably, potentially, to the side of pain. Those gremlins that are supposed to hop off with abstinence never did in his case. Mm-hmm. And so this opioid, this unique opioid, buprenorphine, essentially went on the pleasure side of his balance, not to give him pleasure, but just to restore homeostasis or a level balance and allow him to function and participate in the world and participate in his recovery. So what I talk about in this chapter is sort of like, you know, gosh, how do we make sense of that? One of the ways I make sense of it is that, you know, sometimes heavy, chronic, severe drug use can break that pleasure-pain balance, and people lose the neuroplasticity to restore homeostasis on their own. But another possible interpretation that I also believe is true is that it's sad that we've come to a point where we have to give chemicals like that for people to be able to, like, adapt to this crazy mixed up world. And I believe that that is one of the ways that we are adapting, and in some cases it's probably the only way that people can live in the world. But it makes me sad that we are at a place in society where there aren't other ways to be able to restore that homeostasis and give people, you know, the mental well-being that we all deserve. You know, so things like, you know, one thing about Chris is he never really found community. And of course, community is so important. We're all social creatures. And I think in a way, both his initial use of opioids like heroin were sort of a replacement for his inability to make human connections. And the buprenorphine really just allowed him to kind of progress. And ultimately he did marry and become a father, and, you know, he's doing really well, but he's still on buprenorphine. And I don't know, there's just something, you know, kind of tragic about that.
Absolutely. I mean, but very happy that he has found a homeostasis. Sad that it has to be also a chemical.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
So, well, your story is just wonderful. It's the thing about it is, as you said right in the beginning of the interview, is this is something that every single one of us experiences on some level. Just pick up your smartphone.
Right.
It's kind of crazy. And so the more we're armed with knowledge about this, the more we can, you know, think of the teeter-totter and how we can balance it for ourselves. So a great metaphor as well. Dopamine Nation, our guest is Dr. Anna Limke. Anna, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Anna, thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.